Your first deal ain't going to be easy. As a matter of fact, no deal is easy. Again, learned this from Jason. He said, because if it looks like a simple deal, it's still a complicated deal. Never go into a complicated deal.
You're listening to Driving Performance, your go-to podcast for unmatched expertise in the world of buying and selling an automotive dealership. Each episode features discussions with industry leaders and is brought to you by Performance Brokerage Services, North America's premier family-owned automotive dealership brokerage firm with over 30 years of experience. We're here to ensure you gain the most reliable insights to confidently navigate a transaction and accomplish your unique goals. Whether you're looking to buy or sell, we prioritize building lasting relationships and maximizing the value beyond the transaction level. Here are your hosts, Jamie Farley and Paul Keckney, for another segment of Shifting Gears.
Today, we are excited to be talking with Vikas Mahendru, owner and president of Aaron Automotive Group. Vikas came to this country from India 24 years ago, started his career working in a Subway restaurant, but was encouraged to start working in car sales, where he ended up having tremendous success.
And after holding many positions in a car dealership and working his way up, he decided to take a leap of faith after his son Aaron was born and acquire his first car dealership. He has since grown to 6 car dealerships in 3 years in the San Diego and Southern California area.
Vikas, welcome to the podcast. We're so happy to have you on.
Hey, thank you for having me here. I'm honored and it's a privilege to be a part of this. I'm looking forward to sharing, my journey and how, I can contribute. So yeah, my name is Vikas Mahendru. I'm originally from India. Came here when I was 24 years old and I've been here now 24 years. So I used to work at a Subway, and then got into car business and did every position on the variable side, sold cars, was a finance manager, sales manager. My last job was executive GM for a group managing multiple stores. Aaron was born. Me and my wife, Kriti, decided that we should try and do something for him and leave a legacy behind. And that was the reason, I left a very good job, just took a leap of faith, big risk, probably the worst time. But now we look back, it was the best thing I did. Ford gave us our first store in San Jose. That was our first acquisition. Then we bought a Chrysler store, in Norco, and then we acquired Escondida Ford, Chevrolet, and then another Mitsubishi, another Ford. So currently we own 3 Ford stores, the Chevrolet, the Chrysler, and a Mitsubishi. But again, a lot of gratitude. I think we're blessed to be where we are, and it's fun.
I think you have a really inspiring story. If we can back up just a bit, when you came over here and you're working the Subway restaurant, and then you decided to pivot into car sales, tell us about that. What was the reasoning behind that? And what really resonated with you when you made that decision?
So I came here and 8 months after I came to States, I lost my dad back home. And I'm the eldest one in the family. And I wasn't able to go back and, be with him, do my last rites. To date, it's the biggest loss, in my life. He was relatively young. He was only 52 when he passed away. Mm-hmm. It was a shock, a surprise. So it changed my life. Like instantly in that moment, I realized that I gave up so much in my life. I wasn't able to go back and be with my family for another 4.5 years from that point. So I went back almost 5 years after I came here, 4.5 years after my dad passed away, to be with my family. And I made a promise to myself that even though I cannot make up for the loss, it's a vacuum that's always going to be there, but I can't have an average life. Words in my brain were exactly that. You can't have an average life. You got to try to make a more than average life, provide for family and do something which when my dad is watching, he's proud of me. That's the real truth of it. Because I was happy working at Subway and doing what I was going to do. And the plan was to go back home after 2 years, make some money, go back. It all changed as my dad passed away. So I had to do something more than being at a Subway. So a family friend suggested going car sales. And I was like, okay, car sales is not something that I resonate with. And I don't know anything about cars. And they said something very important. It's not about cars. It's about people. I said, well, I'm very good with people. So just try. And so I was just being myself. I'm a curious person by nature. I've traveled well in my life. I love to, know people, cultures, places, foods, etc. When I related with people, they were not my customers. I was generally trying to connect with them and know them. And process, I was selling cars. Selling cars was never even like on the radar. I just make friends and 45 minutes later, hey, by the way, these are the numbers. you want to say yes. So that's how my journey in car sales was. It's been like that always. I love to know people and connect with people. So that was the reason why I moved from a Subway to car sales. I was like, I got to do something better in my life. And so that was my journey in car business for working for someone. When Aaron was born, I guess that was the second part of it, or evolution from the first part, that, okay, now I need to do something for my kid, for the next generation. And I want to leave, me and my wife, we want to leave a legacy behind. That is the reason. So as you know, and I would like the audience to know that Aaron, you know, everybody asks, who's Aaron? What is Aaron Automotive Group? That's our son. He's 4 and a half now. Awesome. So that's how my journey was. And, you know, that's how I transitioned to, you know, from Subway to car business.
So we get phone calls as brokers probably every week from a general manager that's worked his way up like you did, and probably less than half actually finally can make that leap as you did, make that, you know, very big commitment and leap to go off and go, I'm going to do this. What were the pitfalls, or what would you suggest to that first time general manager trying to be a dealer? Because sometimes they just can't make that leap because it's scary, right? I mean, it's a really big deal to go through and push through all the way to the finish line and finally close in that first store. Any suggestions, or how was your experience, I guess?
So having 6 stores, it's still scary. That scary is never going to go away. So I have different things that I say I've learned from others and I've created my own. People say what you did was crazy. You left a job, which was probably 0.1% in the country. Nobody in their right mind would do it. And my wife was the reason. She said, if anybody can do it, you can do it. And we decided that we're going to do this. And I was like, you are going to be my rock. When I am going to say, oh, I think we made a mistake, I'm going to go and find a job, you're going to put me back together and say, no, continue on this path and journey, and you're going to make it. In those 10 months, when I was sitting home and cold calling people and trying to make these deals, it happened several times that Kriti had to put me back together. The key to this is that, you know, again, learn from somebody. You have to commit first and figure out later. As a human mind, we try to figure everything out in our mind. And then we want to commit to it. By the time we commit to it, it's too late. So you just got to have faith in your ability. You know, you just got to have faith that, okay, I mean, here's the reality of it. If you are doing what you're doing today for somebody else, how is it different if in 6 months you're doing it for yourself? How is it different? If you have ways to financially put this together, if an OEM is willing to back you up, somebody tell me, how is it any different you doing it for somebody today than what you're going to do for yourself or your future generations in 6 months? It's no different. It's all in your head. So the saying that I have is, sometimes crazy is what gets crazy done. So what we have done in these 2.5 years is crazy. Like, you know, people say, how do you? I don't know. But you know what? We made some bold decisions. But what we had is faith. We had faith in our ability. You know, karma is a big component of this. You know, you got to live your life a certain way and doors will open. But you got to have faith in your ability. So that's my message to everybody who's out there, you know, looking for their first store, that you are already doing the job. You're doing it for someone else. All you have to do is, you know, just in your head, make that change. If an OEM is willing to back you up and you have financial means to put a deal together, all you're going to be doing is doing it for yourself in 6 to 8 months. Do it. And worst case scenario, if it doesn't work out, hey, you'll always have a job.
Yep.
You can always find a job. So if I go back to Bob, my previous owner, and say, hey, Bob, I need a job, he'll be happy to hire me back.
As you were acquiring your first dealership, what part of the process did you find was most challenging or surprising to you?
Oh my God, having people believe in you. Having people believe in you. I know what I can do. And it's almost like I'm a horse in a race and I know I'm going to win the race. But I need a jockey, I need a trainer, I need, you know, a race course to run. So I believe in myself so much, but if nobody's willing to, you know, bet on me, it's like a talented actor, a talented player. You know, they could sit on the bench all their you know, careers and nobody gives them a chance. Same with a brilliant actor. If they don't get the break, people don't know if they're good or bad. So I called probably, in general, I probably called 50, 70, 80 people in my contact list. I just cold call everybody. But when it comes to brokers, I think I reached out to about 8, 10, 12. And I'm not going to say all of them brushed me, but I would say that probably, other than Performance, Jason and Jesse, probably one or two, you know, took me seriously. But nobody took me seriously like Jason and Jesse did. They gave me, I think, 45 minutes to an hour on the first phone call when we talked. And I think they connected. They related to my story. You know, they probably heard the passion. It's like, okay, this is somebody that, you know, we want to bet on and then work with. Because I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to tell whoever is going to listen to this, your first deal ain't going to be easy. As a matter of fact, no deal is easy. Again, learned this from Jason. He said, because if it looks like a simple deal, it's still a complicated deal. Never go into a complicated deal because I can't tell you what it look like, right? So there's no easy deals. So you got to have somebody who believes in you, but also can mentor you through this process. And that's what Jason and Jesse did for me. You know, they believed in me. They warned me, they cautioned me, coached me, don't go for this, don't do this. This is the right deal for you. And then when the deal was in works, the seller has pretty much all the power, if you want to call it, as ball is in their court. It's their baby. You know, they want to sell it, they will. They don't want to sell it, they won't, right? So you're almost at their mercy till the moment you actually, you know, have, you know, signed doc and funds are transferred and all that. There's times when you feel like, you know, you are being taken advantage of or you're not being heard. I feel these are emotions and feelings. You know, I don't know how much there's, you know, how much facts there are, but you know, that's how we feel like, okay, and I'm already paying you this much. You're like, why are you trying to squeeze me for an extra few thousand dollars for this and that? But they're all feelings, right? That's where Jason was to me, was the game changer. There were times when I was like, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this out of principle. It's not right. And this and that. We make it about principles because our mind just refuses to accept that, hey, this is what it is. But it's a business deal. You know, we're not judging people. This is not morals and ethics. It's a business deal, right? So, but Jason put me back together, just like Krithi did, you know, in a different space. He's like, Vikas, take a break. Let's talk in 24 hours and then we'll go about it. And he always gave me an option. Vikas, you want to walk away? You can walk away. So what I could tell you or tell people who are listening is that you got to find somebody who believes in you, and then you got to take their mentorship and their coaching and get the deal done. And then once you have done one, then you're in a better position to actually analyze, assess, oh, you know what? I could have done this one and better. And the second one, you can do it better. But that's my suggestion that, you know, the biggest challenge is to find somebody to believe in you. And I think this landscape is changing so rapidly. If we were to look at exact situation 20 years ago, there were not any capital funds. There was the OEMs were not as open to this. I mean, there is a lot of opportunity now for first-time buyers and minority dealers and all of these people to actually be dealer principals. So it's a fun time for somebody who wants to be a first-time dealer. They're in the right space. They're in the right time. You know, there is lenders who are willing to be innovative and structure deals around your needs. And, you know, so it can be done. You just got to, you can't just give up. You got to believe in yourself, your ability, and you got to find somebody else on the other end who will believe in you and just work with you. That's the biggest challenge, finding somebody to say, hey, you know what? We think you can make it.
You know, it's so interesting. One of the things I heard that you said comes up so often, right? Where you get into, there's so many different ways a transaction like this can come apart. And you saying, you know, taking a step back and saying, hey, it's a principle thing and I don't want to do it. But then someone like Jason, you know, one of the founders of our firm saying, hey, wait a second. Do you really want to die on a hill for this? If you want the store, just, it might be a principle thing, but you're not going to get the deal done. And I couldn't agree more with the way you ended up in that situation. One of the questions I have for you moving forward then is, you went from one store to all the way to six in a very short period of time. We find that human capital seems to be the biggest issue. What are you doing for training and how do you grow that model and keep everything together and moving in the same direction without, you know, buying that third store and the first and second one start to hemorrhage a little bit because you're focused on a third one? What have you been doing for training and how have you built your team in the last 3 years?
So first, I will agree with you that people should take it slow. Even though I don't practice that model, but I think that's a smart advice. And you know, we want to make sure that we do it right. We have a moral obligation for the team of 470 people that we have on the team now that we provide for them, you know, not only financially, but a workspace which is mentally healthy. I mean, we got to be there for them. We got to be present for them. I feel like one of the reasons why I was able to acquire good talent was because I was able to connect with everybody. I mean, I at Poway in the first store, I interviewed myself, every technician, every porter, every salesperson. Krithi, my wife, who handles the finance side of it, interviewed everybody in finance aspect of it, business office. So we didn't let our people, you know, this is our kid's name on the building. I think that was the difference. People will work for people or work with people that they respect and they feel like they can, you know, they value, you know, ethics and morals and more than money. So I think that was the realization that as we grew so fast, now at a couple of those stores, I don't have those personal connections. I don't know, you know, the head porter. I don't know all the technicians. And I think that is not who we want to be. You know, we want to be, even though we're going to get to a corporate size one day, you know, we're probably already there, but I want this to be still, you know, a family-owned kind of situation where, hey, everybody knows everybody, and, you know, and there is no, like, you can walk into my office regardless of designation in any of the stores, right? So to answer your question, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that you're right. You know, that is a problem, and people should be careful when they do that. But I think the way our deals happen is because I was a Stellantis FCA person all along. I worked for them for 10 years. So when I got the Ford store, I always had the desire to have an FCA store. So when the Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram store opened up, it was our way from our Poway store. And at that time, FCA, now Stellantis, was doing amazing. And I was like, I can't pass on it. So we bought that store. Then the third store happened to be a Chevrolet, right dead center of these two stores. So how can we pass the third domestic, you know? And then we're like, okay, if we have a Ford in Poway, a Chrysler in Norco, and then we get Chevrolet in Lake Elsinore, we literally within 50 miles or 60 miles, whatever the radius is, we have all three domestic brands. So we can really cover the market. Can't say no to that. At Poway, we started doing so well. We have done very well on the Ford mobile service side of it. We're kind of like their leaders, you know, for Ford in that space. I went to Ford and I wanted to get another Ford store. Escondido Ford came up. We did that. Mitsubishi was acquired for a different reason. We're working with another OEM. Hopefully in another year, we'll have a very good OEM presence there. So, and then Lake Elsinore, they came up to us and said, hey, you're buying stores. So we're thinking of selling. So at that point, it was more about protecting what we had created. I have a Chevy store and then I can't let another Ford operator go in there. If they had a good operator, it hurts my Chevy business. So, and then I love Ford. My personal preference is Ford. We did say no to a lot of deals. You know, again, full disclosure, we probably looked at 30, 40 deals. So we realized quickly that our problem now is not buying stores or money. Our problem is human capital. So it's like, it's a one day at a time. You got to, and it's trial and error. You know, you are going to hire people because you can't really train the 470 people that you have on the team. So at some point in time, you're going to have to hire somebody based on a reference, a resume, you know, or however, you know, seek, you know, your future employees. So we did that and we made a few mistakes and we learned from that. But then I guess it's trial and error that you want people who are going to believe in your vision and connect with you so they can carry forward what you're trying to create. And that's what I think. There are a lot of talented people, and it's not like good or bad. It's just that they do business a certain way. I want to do business a certain way, and we don't align, and that's why we can't work together. But I could tell you that we did have some roadblocks. You know, we had some issues, and you know, we have gone past them. I feel that we're not there where we need to be on the human capital, but we're moving in the right direction. Every day, constantly, we're trying to improve that, you know, human capital portion of it, because that is the most important part of this business, people. It's not the money, it's not the brand, it's not the cars, it's not the location, it's the people. So we're constantly working on it. We have created an in-house training program where we promoted somebody from within. Now we recruit salespeople who have not worked in car business, and they go through internal training program, the tools that we use, you know, how do we need to respond to leads? How do we need to do this? So all the good stuff. How do you clock in? How do you clock out? If you have an issue with human resources, who do you go and see? If you have an issue with this, a lot of times we hire people and we expect that they know already what to do and you know, when they're in a situation, but that's not true. So we're trying to train them so all the bases are covered so they can do the job, which is create sales for us and, you know, and in turn, create a space for themselves, which is financially, you know, rewarding. So we have done that. And in fixed ops, you know, we've also created the same structure where we hire people. We have a pay plan, which is structured based on your growth. So in the service side as technicians, so if you are a loop tech, you know, you are given a roadmap that, okay, in X amount of time, you can become a level three tech. This is the roadmap. So we show them the roadmap. We tell them if they can do these certifications, if they can do these things, then in that time, they can cover the journey and be there. I think that is what's missing. If you tell someone that they can go to a certain point from A to B in this amount of time, and this is what it can do for them and their you know, their financial aspect of their life, I think you don't need to tell them anymore. I think that's enough, that's all they need to know. So we've done that. I don't think so we're done. I don't think so we are anywhere close where we need to be at, but we're aware, we're conscious, and we're working.
I think your comments on the people piece are extremely insightful. So thank you for sharing that. I think that's really great information and perspective for our audience. Switching gears a little bit, you mentioned looking at 30 to 40 deals right before deciding and settling on the opportunities that you wanted to pursue. So I know recently you were on our panel at the latest NAMAD convention. So we were so happy for you to be a part of that. And I'm reflecting back on a comment that you made about valuations. You said something like, the valuation is subjective and it comes down to how much both buyer and seller want it. Kind of a follow-up question to dig into that a little bit. How do you balance the emotional factors with that, with the financial ones when making big decisions like these?
So again, I think I am addressing this question on behalf of a lot of first-time dealers like myself. I am an underdog story, and I'd love nothing more but to be a part of a lot of these underdog stories. If one person can make a decision after listening to this podcast or having been present in that, you know, NAMAD conference that we were, and they get inspired and they make a decision, I think that's a great job done for all of us here. Because I feel that you can do it. It's in your head. You just got to pull the trigger. But to answer your question, when you are going to go and look at a deal as a first-time aspiring dealer, you don't hold a bargaining chip. That's just the reality of it. The person who's selling, they have options. And somebody like Jason and Performance Brokers, somebody who's selling the store, is actually going to take a risk to an extent to deal with the person may or may not get approved with OEM. And they are putting a lot of time and effort into this. A seller, when they get into a buy sell, I don't know, maybe in 3 days of signing an APA, it's public news. It's on first page of automotive news. You can't keep it under wraps. We all know that. So it hurts their business. Now they have to keep their employees intact, you know, keep them going. I mean, it's easily a 4 to 6 month process, you know, from the moment you sign an asset purchase agreement and you actually are in the store. That's a 4 to 6 month process. I mean, what happens to the selling dealer? I mean, if the news goes out, people start leaving. So they are, you know, at a disadvantage, if you want to call it. So have to be very careful in who they want the prospective buyer to be. They're going to take a risk, and they're going to bet on somebody like me, like first-time buyer. They are taking a risk. They're going to want a premium for that. Why would they sell me the store for the same money that they can sell it to a Lithia or Penske for cash and do the deal in 45, 60 days, as opposed to giving it to me? It may be 6 months, and there may never be a deal because OEM will roll for me, or I may not perform on my financial, you know, obligations. There's a lot of other things which are out of our control. Not that people are going in knowing that, hey, I don't know if I'm going to get approved. Let me take a chance. Nobody's going to leave their job and try to do this, but things can still go left and right. So to answer your question, I feel that valuation is what you can afford to pay. So if somebody's asking for X dollars and you feel like, okay, they're asking 10%, 20% more, and I want to buy it at the right price, that is probably the number one reason a lot of these people who want to be dealers are not dealers today, because they just feel they're paying too much. I mean, I don't even think so. It's the commitment part of it. It's that making sense in their head. Oh, the store only makes so much. Why are they asking so much? But what is your plan B? Where are you going to find a store which you will get for what you want to pay, right? It only exists in our heads. It's just an illusion. It's just the imaginary, you know, dealership. It doesn't exist in the real world. So they have to pay a little more. It's okay. It's just your cost of getting to the big boy club, or, you know, car club. I shouldn't say boy, you know, it's your cost, you know, you getting into the club. And then that's basically it. So when we bought the first store, we realized we were going to pay a little more, but then seller took a leap of faith. You know, they say, okay, you know what? Vikas may or may not perform. They had their reservations. Jason Stopnitsky and Performance Brokers worked with me for 6 months. That is time. That is investment. They had people working with me, and I was a first-time buyer, you know, no proven track record. So you can't expect to get the same deal. It's almost like you buy cars from me as a fleet customer, and you buy 30 a year, or you're going to buy one a year, and you expect that you get the same price point. You know, there's some concession that's there to be had. So again, valuation is subjective. The way I would say tell anybody is, if you have the means to pull a deal together, OEM is willing to back you up, and you have ability in your fit that you can make it work, I'm going to repeat what Jason said. If you get your first store in 10 years, you're not going to remember what you paid, because you will have many more. And I'm just repeating what Jason taught me. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter what you pay. If you can get the deal done, get your first deal done, get your foot in the door, learn the nuisances of business, because I'll tell you, people warned me. Just like they used to say, if you don't have kids, when you have kids, your life is going to change. It's like, okay, I can understand. Well, when it happened, oh yeah, it did change. You just don't know. It's the same thing when you change this position from working for someone and now you work for yourself. It's day and night. It's very different. You don't know till you actually sit in that chair, the emotions and the pressures and the stress level of, you know, what you have to do. It's very different. So they just got to be ready for it. And I feel they can't expect to get a deal done at a certain number if somebody else is also at a number and they're just not proven. I mean, it's harsh, but you have to accept that. And I feel that's why a lot of people don't pull the trigger because they want to get a deal.
You know, Vegas, when I was buying my first store, I bought a Chevy store first, and we were $200,000 apart. And I called my mentor, who I worked for 9 years. And he said, "Paul, how long have you been looking for a store?" I said, 3 years. He said, "How much do you make a year?" And at that point, it was $150,000 just a year, 25 years ago. And he said, "How much do you think you'll make in your first year?" I said, "Well, my pro forma is $600,000." He said, "So you're going to go back and sit in the bench for 3 more years?" I had an aha moment and went and bought the store. So I think that's exactly what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, 100%. And then here's another part that I try to share with my friends and, you know, business acquaintances, right? I like to share this with them. Our lives are just like cars. There is a time frame which is under warranty. And then you buy an extended warranty and then the car breaks down. We have a prime time in our lives, which is where we currently are. Your health, your mental space, your family, the support that you need, not at work, but at home. It's all in place. And this is your moment to do it. It's not always going to be like this. People forget that. People think we're going to be young and healthy, and we're going to have this space available to us forever. It's going to change. So in 10 years, if you can get a deal which is cheaper or exactly how you want it, you may not have the juice left in you to run as fast, as hard, or your mental space. Everything else in your life may not be in the same space. So if you have everything else checked off that you have ready to go, the mental support, the support from your family, you know, people around you, you have team ready to go, you have an OEM ready to go, you have the financial, you know, backing ready to go, and you are stuck on a few $100,000, it's not a smart move.
Yeah. So you talked when we were together at NAMAD, we talked now just a minute ago about first time buyers. But for you now, if you're looking at a deal, I think at NAMAD, you were saying it's not just, you know, so many people that have three stores or maybe looking at their fourth store or fifth store, they look at it and say, well, you know, there's an article out there that says I shouldn't pay more than 4x earnings. Meanwhile, maybe the store is only 20% sales effective or so many other factors, as you know, that may come into play. How are you now looking, when you're looking at a deal, how do you evaluate it now compared to maybe back then or just holistically? How do you look at the whole thing and evaluate a store?
I can tell you it's one word, a scale. How do you scale? If the store is within, so let's say we have 6 stores, they're 80 miles apart, right? So from one point to another point, everything in between, it's 80 miles. If a store exists within that space, then I don't have to drive any further. If the store adds to my existing portfolio, I can diversify. I can scale, which means I can still have the same controller, corporate controller, adding one more store to her with 3 more people to run the business office in a lot. But if you do a standalone store, which is 300 miles away, but I can get it for $1 million less, I'm not going to do that deal because how I'm going to manage the store, I'm going to run the store. So the value of the store is the value to you. It's not like anything else, that if I have a store which falls within the same demographic, I can scale it. You know, I can have the same used car director. I can have the same fixed op director. And then it's just an addition to my existing structure without adding too much. I'm saving a lot of money and I'm already positive going in. So if I look at their employee roster, right? So let's say they have 85 people employed right now to do X number of business. If this store falls within existing demographic that I have, I can probably run that store with 65 people, or let's say 70 people, or even 75 people. So right off the bat, I can take off 10 people that they have, because if they are doing a certain volume, they need a dispatcher in the service drive. Okay, they need an internal writer. They need a business office manager. They need a used car manager. I mean, depending on how their structure is, when you have this structure that we have created, you can scale it. The way I look at deals now is like, what can I manage? If I have a deal in Texas today, which I love to, but I'm not going to do it because I'm not ready to touch on your point that, you know, I'm not ready with my human capital yet. Maybe in 2 years, I'll have that covered. Then yes, we want to expand out of California, go to Texas, you know, go to Arizona, go to Nevada. But for now, we are expanding. We have a strategy that is that I'm only going to buy what I can drive. And that's it. So I don't want to drive any further than what my last store is. Maybe another 10 minutes, 20 minutes, sure, but no further than that. because that's where we can be efficient. So when somebody who has two or three stores, it's going to depend on their motivation. Why do they want to buy? Do they have next generation coming in? Do they have a succession plan? Somebody else wants to come in and do it. If they have three or four stores, I have to believe that they've been doing it for a minute, right? So what is the motivation? And motivations are different. I have a very dear friend. He's a single point owner, very successful Hyundai dealer. And all of a sudden, he saw me that, you know, I'm buying stores. So he woke up. He's like, hey, I want to buy more stores. And he has been doing this, God knows, 35 years, right? So I'm like, your son doesn't want to be in the business. Why do you? Oh, it's good to be. I mean, it's important that people will have to ask themselves, like, what is my motivation? But I say valuation of these stores is going to be really directly tied to how they can make them work. If I can buy a store a mile from my existing store, and it works for what I'm trying to, how I'm trying to expand, you know, diversity, strategy, different OEM, however I'm looking at, I'll pay a premium, I'll pay a little more. But you can offer me a store which is 3 hours away from me for less than market price, I'm just not interested. So that's how we went through all these 30, 40 different opportunities. And we were like, okay, we can't do it. You know, you want to do it. Some of these were very good stores. And I knew, right, like looking at them, like, oh my God, we can certainly go in and make a difference. But then again, how are you going to do it? So it's very different.
The value of the store is the value to you. I love the way that you frame that up.
It certainly is. And it's hard to explain this to somebody who has already bought stores. And we all know that our journeys to this point have been different, right? Somebody got into the store because, you know, the dealer principal got sick, had no succession plan. They got the store. God bless. Somebody was an accountant, but that was the trustee and they trust them. I mean, there is different ways and different journeys in how people have acquired stores. So sometimes we give more credit than due, you know, but I think, you know, if you want to put it in a smart way, if it works for you in your existing strategy, you can get it done, because you'll be making money for the rest of your life. It's almost like real estate. You know, should you pay a little more for a piece of property that's only going to come in market once in 30, 40 years? Absolutely. Because even if I pay 10% more, okay, I'm 10% more today, in 2 years, I'll be break even. And then after that, 30 years of that property, I'm only appreciating. So it's just how you look at things. As human, we are wired certain ways, right? So sometimes we're only looking for ways to make deals. And sometimes we're only looking for ways not to make deals. And you'll find a lot of successful entrepreneurs, they'll always find a way to make a deal. And then I'm sure you guys for sure deal with a lot of people who are always going to find a way not to make a deal. So,
well, I think it's great advice from your perspective and from your journey. Are there any other lessons that you learned during the acquisition process that you could share?
Yeah, don't worry about the money. Don't worry about anything else. Make sure your personnel, make sure your human capital is covered. You know, I tell you that you got to be ready that your bases are covered. So if you want to break it down, an automotive dealership is broken down into four aspects, you know, variable, fixed ops, and business office. That's it. Fixed ops is parts and service, but you got to make sure you have people to cover those bases. I am a variable expert. I know fixed ops enough. I know business office enough. But if I have to run my business office, I can't. I can't go in and close my statement. You know, I certainly can't. And the same thing with fixed ops. Can I go and write tickets? Maybe for one day, I'll make a lot of errors, but I certainly cannot run my shop. So you got to be careful that when you're going into these deals, people sometimes like to work on these as task one, task two, task three. So my advice, or what I want to share with you know, future aspiring dealers is, you got to create your to-do list, which works simultaneously. One task doesn't have to finish for the second to start. Literally, they are working in tandem. You're working on acquiring talent at the same time you're working in trying to raise funds. In the same time, you're trying to do your you know, dealer application. They all work in tandem. You can't have everything ready. You're approved. Your deal is done and it's going to close in 30 days. And then you go, oh, okay, now let me go and find talent because I need a service manager or I need a business office manager. That's where I struggled the most. You know, when we acquired one and then second relatively quickly, I had some difficulties, you know, getting right people to run certain aspects of the business. That's what I'd like to share. So make sure you have good people around you who can cover these bases.
Question for you. One of the areas that we find can really slow a deal down, sometimes cause it to break, is when it gets to the attorney stage and they're working on agreements. Not asking for your attorney's name, but are you still using the same one that you started with day one? And how is your experience with that? Because we find that, you know, if we're not careful and a buyer specifically has an attorney that's not responsive, not engaged, can prevent the deal from happening? I see you smiling. I'm curious about that.
This is more of your life philosophy than business question. We associate with people like ourselves. If I'm a poker player, my friends will be poker players, more than likely. If I'm a cigar person, my friends will be cigar people. If I'm a wine person, when we associate with people, we hang out with people, we deal with people who are similar to ours, right? It's not a good or bad thing. It's just, preference thing. So I go back to the previous point. When you have somebody who will always try to find a reason to say no, more than likely their team is the same way, because that's the reason they work together. That's the reason they get along, because they get on a phone call. Guess what? Both of them are saying the same. See, I told you shouldn't do that. Remember that? Oh yeah, I told you that. Oh no, you remember that? Man, I knew that. So it's like, okay.
It's so true.
One is saying no, the other one is saying no with an exclamation mark, and the other one is saying no with an underline. It's just like, it's a no and a no and a no. But it's hard to find good counsel. So I think, to answer your question, yes, I still have the same people. As far as, my support staff, my support team is still the same from day one. Jason and Jesse, performance brokers, always my number one. My attorney is the same. My outside CFO is the same. I mean, they were the reason why I got this done in the first place. I have no reason to change them. Why would I fix something which is not broken? They have given me good advice, and they have always been by my side. But how I associated with them is also by chance. But I also feel I get along with somebody because we look at things the same way. So if we talk once a month and we're just business acquaintances, right? We've done some business at some point in time, and we're just talking and we know each other for a certain amount of time. And I say, hey, you know what? My attorney just retired. What do you think? Who should I go for? Because you and me do business the same way, we agree to things more than not. You'll refer me somebody, but you'll refer me somebody who's worked with you or you know of has similar qualities, or they look at things from the same lens that I do and you do. So then I won't have a problem working with that person because we align, right? So I feel when these attorneys are saying no, it's really a reflection of the person you're dealing with who's actually your principal. They're only going to work at my pace. There's no way if I send them something and they don't respond. If I don't want the deal bad enough, it's a funny story. So somebody called me out of blue, like, oh, I heard a rumor you're selling the store. I said, no, I'm not. And then it goes away. A month later, I get another text. Oh, I heard again that, so I said, call him because, I don't want to do this on the text. He doesn't respond to my text. Supposedly, he wants to buy a store. Very bad. First time buyer. Anyways, I don't know if you want to if you want to put this on podcast, but I just want to share this with you. So I said, okay, call me. So this was at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I get no text message, no call. Next morning at 9 o'clock, sorry, I got tied up. Can we connect today? I said, you didn't want the store that bad. So I wanted to share this with you because if somebody's saying, I've been waiting for 10 years to get married, and they see somebody, they're like, oh my God, this is the person I want to get married. And you then, when you have your moment and you don't ask that you want to get married, then what are you doing? So if he's asking me, hey, you want to sell? I said, no. Then he asked me again, oh, there is a rumor. Do you want to sell? I said, call me. That call me could be mean. Yes, I want to sell. Not that I wanted to. But if I was that person, I would have called that person back in 15 seconds. And that's how bad I wanted. This guy doesn't respond. But that's, I think, the basic problem in this. People want it, but they don't want it bad enough. And if they want it, they just don't want to put in the work. But somebody who wants it bad enough, I promise you, they will find a way and they will be a dealer principal.
Yeah, agreed.
So your automotive group is named after your son, Aaron. How does building this legacy for your family influence the way you run your dealerships?
It's just your core value. And I said it earlier, your business is a reflection of who you are in life. We just don't change. It's not like I get up in the morning, I put a suit on and I'm a different person. Okay. It's like I switch, and I'm like, oh, now I'm a business person. The core values still stay the same. I want to take a moment in saying thank you to a lot of people. Like, I don't think so. 1 hour is enough for me to go through every name. This was a team effort, collective effort. I'm just blessed to be sitting here and representing all of them, but there was a lot of work which was done behind the scenes. So a lot of gratitude, my family, we had to go through our hardships, not necessarily financially, but more, of emotional support and, losing my dad, not going back. The journey was not as easy as it seems, but in the end, it was worth it. It was fruitful. My wife for sure. There's zero chance I'd be sitting here if it wasn't for her. She's a reason that why I was able to pull the trigger. I always wanted to. I might have done it even if She wasn't there, but I don't know. But I can tell you for sure, with her, there was zero chance we wouldn't have done it. So that's the difference. Like with her besides me, that was the reason we pulled the trigger. And there's still days we go to our work and you know what's going on, but she's been the rock. And certainly I feel Aaron is the reason why we're here. You know, when he was born, he gave us a reason to do this. And we feel like the doors opened and it just become a lot easier. I don't know how. I think all the karma, you know, was adding up and it's just started to like, you know, fall in place. But we want to do business differently. You know, that's a reason, you know, I left my job. I didn't leave my job to make more money. The reason was not that, oh, I want to show them how good I am. My motivation was to try and do it the right way. Try to do it a different way where you don't have to, you know, screw people. You don't have to do false promises. You lead by example. It's a tough road, but, you know, it's easy to talk smack, you know, sitting on the couch, watching a reality TV show and while you're but it's hard when you're in the elements, like, you know, let's see how we can do it. That's what kind of like the motivation was. Let's see if we can do this different and leave a legacy behind. So to answer your question, Jamie, with Aaron's name on the building, with Aaron's name on our t-shirts, with Aaron's name on literally everything that we do, there's zero chance we're going to do it any other way but integrity. You have to have integrity in how you do business. And that's how we want to run and lead this group. And it's not easy. You know, people don't believe in you. People don't believe in things that you do, you know. And we're not out there to prove them wrong. We're just going to show up every day and continue doing business the same way that we believe it should be done. And it's the right way. Do your business with integrity. We do give back. We are involved with our local communities. We go above and beyond, you know, taking care of our people. I'm very proud. It gives you a feeling of being whole. You know, it's not the bottom line profits. It's like, hey, you actually, you know, show up for your people. And showing up for your people doesn't mean writing checks. Showing up for people mean if somebody's sick and is in hospital and, you know, is just struggling with something, just checking up on them. Hey, you know, you need something. Are you okay? Just a simple text message from you as a dealer principal or somebody higher up in the management is all they need. Now they feel, okay, you know, I'm a part of this team. And, you know, that's who we are. That's Aaron Automotive Group. And we hope that one day this could be, that's who they are. And it's not a one-year thing. That's kind of like our motivation to show up every day. We're happy. We're high in life. A lot of gratitude. You know, we're blessed to be where we are, playing at the position that we're playing. But we want to contribute, you know, and pay forward. So hopefully we can live in others' lives. You know, if you make a very minuscule positive difference in others' lives, then we live in their lives. So it's a very selfish reason deep down. I personally want to live in a lot of people's legacies. So I want to contribute in a very small, different ways that I can. You know, I can live in their legacies forever. So, you know, you become immortal.
Amazing, Vikas.
I am an underdog story. I come from a third world country with not enough money, $700 in my pocket. And that's reality. I came to the States 24 years ago with $700 in my pocket. So again, I did not get here all by myself. There were a lot of people who were instrumental in my journey, in my growth, in giving me the opportunities. From the first general manager who looked at me and go like, I think you can be a management material. I was so fresh off the board, I didn't even know what that means. I didn't want to ask him because he was my GM. And I was like, oh, it's embarrassing to ask him. So I walk out, I ask somebody else, what does that mean? He's like, he's saying that you can be a manager. I said, oh, okay, that's good to hear. So I still remember that, right? That changed me in a certain way, gave me the confidence to do more. So there's a lot of people in this journey who did their bit. And I want to be that resource. I want to be that person for anybody who's out there. So I'm an underdog story. So if there's anybody out there who feels like, oh, you know what, I am an underdog, you know, and nobody gives me a chance and nobody thinks that, you know, takes me seriously and nobody thinks that I can do it. I'll do whatever I can within my means to facilitate. I'm nobody to help anybody, but I will play my part and I'll facilitate what I can, make connections, you know, be a guide, you know, be a mentor, be a coach, you know, whatever you want it to be a reference. But yes, I want to be available to that because again, I think that is what contributes to your karma. And that is one of the big reasons that why we sit here today.
That's fantastic. How could people reach out to you?
They can send me an email. You know, you guys are more than welcome to share my email. But I mean, I'm more than happy to connect with them via LinkedIn, either one of those. Yeah.
Perfect.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Driving Performance. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review. If you're considering buying or selling an automotive dealership, reach out to us at performancebrokerageservices.com or send an email to info@performancebrokerageservices.com.